This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, listener-supported radio. This is the Radio EcoShock Show, and I am your host, Alex Smith. We've all seen the large number of powerful women who lead and campaign in the environmental movement. Some define themselves as ecofeminists, but what does that mean?
There are other ecofeminists who take a different perspective. They would claim that there is, in fact, some truth in the ideology that women are closer to nature. But they see this closeness to nature as having been distorted by patriarchy to dominate both women and nature as inferior to this male elite. But for them, this distortion is really rooted in a very deep essential truth. And again, I have some sympathy with that view, although I always have this niggling fear that the ultimate message is that women get to do all the recycling. You know, the men get to mess it up, and then we get to clean it up, you know, this kind of stuff.
Today we present a speech by Rosemary Radford Ruther in Vancouver on July 3, 2007. The topic is Ecofeminism, a Global Comparative Approach. I had some reservations about going to this speech. Dr. Ruther is a Catholic theologian. She is the author or editor of 42 books, including Gaia and God, an Ecofeminist Theology of Earth Healing, 1992, and Women Healing the Earth, Third World Women on Feminism, Religion, and Ecology, published in 1996. Would this speech try to convert me or neglect people with different views? Not at all. Dr. Ruther avoids a narrow religious approach. She quickly examines three different views of how women relate to nature in a patriarchal society which aims to dominate both. Then Ruther moves on to the life and philosophy of two ecofeminists in the developing world.
I've actually studied a number of people, but for the space of tonight's talk, I will talk about two ecofeminist perspectives that are emerging from different contexts, one of them from India and the other from Brazil. So these two people that I will talk about is Vandana Shiva from India and Ivone Gabada from Brazil.
With the broad reach formed after 40 years of feminism and ecology, she leaves white middle-class environmentalism behind. Suddenly, we find out about women directly impacted by polluted air and water and missing forests. Ruther outlines a Hindu rejection of Western-style development, and then South American organizing of the poorest women to save the environment around them. Let's enjoy this speech by a wise woman, Dr. Rosemary Ruther.
Some of these introductions are so awesome, you know, you almost feel like you should leave while the going's good. But I'm supposed to give a lecture, and I will do that, on the subject of ecofeminist philosophy, theology, and ethics, in which I will bring comparative perspective from the several non-Western worlds. So starting out with the term ecofeminism, which is not necessarily a term on everyone's lips. So what does this term mean? Basically, it's a coinage of the terms feminism and ecology. So it's an effort to talk about the interconnections between the domination of women and the domination of nature. And this interconnection is very typically made on two different levels, the ideological or cultural level and the socioeconomic level. So I'll try to define those very briefly. On the ideological cultural level, women are said to be closer to nature or closer to the body, matter, emotions, the animal world. And on the socioeconomic level, women then are socially located, in the spheres of reproduction, child raising, food preparation, spinning, weaving, cleaning, all kinds of very vital activities, but which unfortunately are also typically devalued roles in relationship to the public sphere of male power and culture. Now, my assumption is that the first level, the ideological level, is in fact what a good Marxist would call the ideological superstructure, the ideological superstructure of the second socioeconomic location of women. In other words, claiming that women are, quote, naturally closer to the natural world and somehow lack the capacity for intellectual and leadership roles, therefore justifies locating them in this devalued sphere of material work and excluding them from higher education and public leadership. In other words, the ideology is attempting to justify that social limitations of women. Now, many ecofeminist thinkers would also include in this analysis what I would call a broadly eco-justice perspective. By eco-justice, I mean including class, race, and ethnic hierarchies. That is to say, devalued classes and races of both men and women are also said to lack intellectual capacity, leadership, therefore denied higher education, located socially in the spheres of physical labor as serfs or slaves or servants in households, farms, and workshops. And so the fruits of this, again, this kind of devalued work, like that of wives in the family, are then appropriated by a male elite as the base of wealth and power and freedom. Freedom to exercise these roles of power and culture. So it is this, basically this male ruling class, which is the master class that define themselves as owning these various dependent classes of people. And this master class or ruling class inscribes its views in the systems of law, philosophy, and theology, what Val Plumwood calls the master narrative, or the logic of domination, which defines the normative human in terms of this master class. For example, for Plato, and even more perhaps for Aristotle, the free Greek male was seen as the normative human being. For Descartes, major philosopher for early modern Europe, we have a deepening of this Greek dualism between mind and body, seeing all reality, physical reality, as, quote, dead matter to be pushed and pulled by external mechanical force. And so the mind is seen as standing outside of matter, contemplating it and controlling it from beyond. So we have this kind of pattern of thought down through the history of Western philosophical thought. Now, this master narrative, with its logic of domination, has structured Mediterranean and Western societies for thousands of years. And since the 16th and 17th century, it has been extending its control throughout the globe, eliminating smaller indigenous societies with which sometimes had alternative, more egalitarian and nature-sustaining social and cultural patterns. And most other urban civilizations and religions, such as Hinduism in India or Confucianism in China, which of course also had patriarchal social and ideological patterns, but nevertheless often retained some sense of the sacrality of nature. And these these major alternative cultures are also tending to be pushed aside in the 20th and 21st century for the one triumphal master narrative of Western science and market economics. So that's, you know, kind of a brief introduction of what the term ecofeminism is trying to refer to. Now, how do ecofeminists envision a transformation of this deeply rooted and powerful ideology and social system? There are, of course, some feminists who have objected to any connection between women, domination of women and domination of nature, seeing this as reduplicating the basic patriarchal fallacy that somehow women have some kind of connections with the non-human world more than men. They believe that women need to kind of claim their equal humanity with men, their parallel capacity for rationality and leadership. And so they too, like men, should be understood as separate from and called to rule over nature. In other words, they should share in the dominion over nature. But it seems to me this solution to the problem of women's subordination ends with basically assimilating a few elite women into the male master class without really changing the basic hierarchies of ruling class over dominated humans and non-humans. We could think of a few names we won't go into. Of course, but most women still remain subordinated in the house and in low-paying menial jobs. And even the few elite women who make it into the cabinets and the boardrooms of the powerful, still remain a very small group. And of course, the same can be said of racial ethnic men. So you have basically a token inclusion of women, black or white, and racial ethnic men, whose presence then buttresses the claim that U.S. society, and perhaps other societies, but U.S. society is completely inclusive and open to talent from whatever group, and the many who do not make it have no one to blame but themselves. So you have, in effect, a kind of show of equality which masks the reality of a system in which the super wealth and power of the few really depends on the exploitation of the many. There are other ecofeminists who take a different perspective. They would claim that there is, in fact, some truth in the ideology that women are closer to nature. But they see this closeness to nature as having been distorted by patriarchy to dominate both women and nature as inferior to this male elite. But for them, this distortion is really rooted in a very deep essential truth. I use the word essential advisedly here. That women, by virtue of their feminine bodies, their child-bearing functions, and so on, are in fact more attuned to the rhythms of nature, more in touch with their bodies, more in touch with nature, more holistic, and so on. So women, in fact, need to claim this affinity with nature, and in fact take the lead in creating new earth-based spiritualities and practices of care for the earth. And again, I have some sympathy with that view, although I always have this niggling fear that the ultimate message is that women get to do all the recycling. You know, the men get to mess it up, and then we get to clean it up, you know, this kind of stuff. However, it seems to me that most ecofeminists, and certainly the ones that I have would identify myself with, would reject any essentializing of women as more in tune with nature by virtue of their female body and maternity. So they would see this concept of affinity between women and nature as a social construct that both naturalizes women and feminizes non-human nature, thereby, of course, making them appear to be remarkably similar to each other. Now, of course, it could also be said that because women are socially located in certain spheres of activity, that they also perhaps suffer more or could be more aware of the abuse of the natural world, and therefore become more concerned about this abuse. But this, for me, would also be a matter of their particular social location rather than to a, quote, different nature than men. And such experiences, such sensitivity to the abuse of nature would itself certainly vary by class and cultural location. For example, elite women, Western women living perhaps within the technological comforts of affluent urban society, could be quite oblivious to the stripping of forests or the poisoning of waters, while a peasant woman who has to struggle for the livelihood of her family in immediate relationships to this kind of reality, walking long distances to gather wood and water and so on, could be very aware of these realities. But this awareness, of course, would not necessarily translate into mobilization for change. In other words, for that, one needs to have more than just awareness that nature is being abused. One has to have some kind of ways of bringing this to consciousness and mobilizing leadership that can translate into organized resistance to dominant power and shaping some alternatives to it. So with that, again, that kind of introduction to some of the range of what the term ecofeminism can come to mean, I want to then talk or compare two people that I find particularly significant as ecofeminists. I've actually studied a number of people, but for the space of tonight's talk, I will talk about two ecofeminist perspectives that are emerging from different contexts, one of them from India and the other from Brazil. So these two people that I will talk about is Vandana Shiva from India and Ivone Gabara from Brazil. And then I'll conclude with some questions about the utility of this effort, the usefulness of this effort to connect women, nature, social justice, and ecological health. Starting with Vandana Shiva, she is, of course, a Hindu in background. She was trained as a physicist, but abandoned her career in nuclear energy to become an environmental activist who writes and organizes against Western systems of development, which she sees as destroying the ecology and economy of India and causing destruction and impoverishment of humanity and the earth worldwide. Vandana Shiva seeks to propose sustainable alternatives to the Western model of development, alternatives rooted in traditional Indian peasant agriculture. Her first major book was Staying Alive, Women, Ecology, and Development. It was published in 89, and she has a number of subsequent books, such as The Violence of the Green Revolution, Biopiracy, Stolen Harvest. She has one on water and so on. So she's a very prolific writer. And Vandana Shiva speaks of both Western science and Western development as, quote, projects of patriarchy. She sees Western developmentalism as picking up in the post-World War II world where colonialism left off. Really, in a certain sense, a continuation of colonialism or neo-colonialism. For her, British colonialists in India had stripped forests for timber to build their ships and railroads and organized the land for expropriation into wealth that supported the empire. And in the post-colonial world, it becomes the national elites of India who continue the same model of expropriation and plunder in the name of modernization and development. For Shiva, this model of development is built on the false assumption that both nature and women are mere passive objects that are unproductive in themselves. And both nature and human labor become productive only when they are taken into a system that uses them for profit within the dominant system of accumulation. And this model of development is claimed to produce wealth for all. Famous phrase, lifting all boats. But it actually creates only a short-term extraction of wealth for a global elite while impoverishing women, poor people, and nature itself, and destroying the very base of life on which it is founded. So for Shiva, this destructive results of this model of development is not accidental, but is itself rooted in a distorted epistemology of Western science. So she draws strongly on several Western feminist critics of science, such as Susan Harding and Evelyn Keller, and particularly Carolyn Merchant. And Shiva defines Western science as based on an epistemology of male domination over both women and nature. And this epistemology abstracts the male knower into a transcendent space outside of nature and reduces nature itself to dead matter pushed and pulled by mechanical force. So Western science, to use the phrase that Carolyn Merchant made famous, Western science kills nature. That is to say, it denies that it possesses self-generating, self-organizing, organic life.
You are listening to Ecofeminism, a Global Comparative Approach. It was recorded by Radio EcoShock in the Unitarian Church of Vancouver on July 3, 2007. The speaker is Dr. Rosemary Ruther. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, listener-supported radio.
Now, India, like many other industrializing countries, has been traditionally a rural society, based largely on subsistence agriculture, in which women traditionally played a very important part. And for Shiva, Indian rural women have been the base of a sustainable system of subsistence agriculture because they have experimentally come to understand the interconnections between the cycles of life, of land and animals, which they tended. But Western science and developmentalism tends to see this kind of work of women as unproductive and the forests that they tend as mere wasteland because they have not been incorporated into a system of commodities for profit in the market of international exchange. In other words, until forests become lumber, they are worthless. So Shiva is mounting a very severe criticism against this whole Western style of imposition of agricultural development on India, and particularly she has this critique of the Green Revolution. And this revolution, which was, you know, popularized a few decades ago, promised abundance to poor third world farmers through an increased grain supply, but its actual effect has been a disaster. Women were eliminated from subsistence agriculture, and with it their roles as the maintainer of sustainable soils, forests, and food for humans and animals. And instead, petroleum-based fertilizers, pesticides, and fuels for tractors are brought in, which have gradually poisoned the soil and the waters, and the water table itself becomes depleted through overuse for irrigation. In other words, these kind of high-yield crops demand a much higher use of water and pesticides and fertilizers and so on. So the rivers and wells dry up. Regions that had sufficient water suffer water famine. And farmers are forced to buy their seeds, fertilizers, pesticides, and fuels, and to sell their harvest to companies which charge them high prices and, of course, pay them low wages. So the result is an impoverishment of the people and the land. And yet this disastrous model continues to be promoted by Western global corporations, development banks, and national elites as the epitome of modernization. Now, Shiva's solution to this disaster of modernization and development is, in fact, to reclaim, perhaps in a more sophisticated form, traditional sustainable agriculture. She thinks there has to be a recovery of the ecological knowledge of how forests, water, plants, animals, and humans are maintained in a renewable system of interaction, a partnership which is based on nature's own cycles of renewal. And she sees peasant women and tribal peoples as privileged repositories of this ecological knowledge. So instead of seeing them as sort of ignorant and primitive and unproductive, one has to, in fact, learn from these people how to maintain genuine life with nature. So for Shiva, this whole Western model of knowledge and economic value has proven to be delusory. And we have to shift to a different understanding of knowledge and economic value. So the epistemological model that we need is not one of domination, not dominating mind over body, but rather how to think within nature's own system of interrelationships. So the economic system that produces true value is one that maintains, and does not destroy nature, one that cooperates with it and fits humans within its own cycles of self-maintenance. Now, Shiva also turns to traditional Hindu cosmology to express the worldview that is needed for the recovery of ecological knowledge and life-sustaining practice. And she speaks of this recovery as the, quote, feminine principle, but I think she tries to make clear that she's not talking in terms of a Western ideology of femininity over against masculinity, a sort of binaries of aggressive activity and passivity, but rather as in a Hindu context of a dynamic interaction of creative energy, female Shakti, together with the male form of Purusha, which together produce nature, Prakriti. So for her, this kind of Hindu tradition in which Shakti, which is activating energy, and Prakriti, which is nature, have both been understood as, in fact, as goddesses, as female cosmic powers. So she feels that this traditional Hindu culture, both in its high philosophy and in its popular spirituality, have understood women as active principles in the maintenance of life. That was a controversial piece of her thought, which I think she's tended to downplay a little bit later. But she in her first book particularly, she tried to recover that kind of vision of this female cosmic energy or Shakti. Now the second figure I want to discuss is Ivone Gabada, a Brazilian Catholic feminist theologian. She would call herself an ecofeminist. And she has a number of books, some of them in English and some of them not. One of her books is called Intuiciones Ecofeministas, or Ecofeminist Intuitions. And in this, she talks about how she came to adopt an ecofeminist perspective. She acknowledges that some Latin American feminists have criticized this term, again, as, you know, they were afraid that it was stereotyping women as somehow closer to nature, but she believes that her own viewpoint has nothing to do with an essentializing anthropology of women and men, but rather it simply springs from her own concrete experience in her impoverished neighborhood in the northeast of Brazil. And there she has for many years observed that poor women are simply the ones who have to cope with the problems of air pollution, poverty, poor quality of food, lack of clean drinking water, and the like. In other words, that women kind of are involved in their daily struggles with these kind of realities as a part of what it means to survive. And it's in this context that she talks about ecofeminism as rooted in the concrete realities of poor women struggling to survive in this polluted and impoverished environment. So in one of her essays, Gabara speaks of doing her theology between noise and garbage. Doing her theology between noise and garbage. Now the noise is that of a crowded neighborhood, noisy with machinery and trucks and cars, not to mention the shouts and loud music of the many people who live in close proximity and seeking to survive on a day-to-day basis. And the garbage is the waste of a society disproportionately discarded where poor people live with little organized cleanup. And so to do one's theology in noise and garbage is really to do it simply with a daily awareness of the oppression of the poor and the degradation of their environment. But it's also to do theology inspired by the vitality of the poor, who, in spite of everything, manage to keep on going and to even celebrate fiesta despite these challenges. So Gabara would see her ecofeminist theology as I said, rooted in this concrete experience, but she would also see it, in her view, as a third stage of feminist theological work in Latin America. The first stage in the 1970s recognized women were indeed oppressed in some particular ways as women, as historical subjects. And then in the second stage, women began to, after, you know, acknowledging that women did indeed have some distinctive kinds of oppressions as women, women began to question the dominance of masculine theological symbols and to search for a kind of alternative feminine language for the divine, such as wisdom. So she sees these as kind of two early stages of Latin American feminism. But for Gabara, both of these stages are still expressions of what she would call patriarchal feminism. That is to say, a feminism which has not yet deeply examined the androcentric model of theology of God and the cosmos, but are still seeking to include women in it, what Mary Hunt calls add women and stir. But you still have the same, you know, recipe. Now, Gabara sees ecofeminism as moving to a more radical stage of feminism that calls for the deconstruction of patriarchal thinking with this hierarchical structure and methodology of thought. Ecofeminism, for her, is an effort to dismantle the whole paradigm of male over female, mind over body, heaven over earth, transcendence over immanence, and the notion of a male god sort of epitomizing all of these kind of transcendent powers outside of and ruling over the created world. In other words, an effort to dismantle that paradigm and to imagine an alternative to it. Now, changing the patriarchal paradigm for an ecofeminist one, again for Gabara, starts with epistemology. It's interesting that the understanding of epistemology keeps coming back in these thinkers. So for her, it starts with epistemology. In other words, we need to change the way that we think. Patriarchal epistemology has based itself on eternal, unchangeable truths that are the presupposition for knowing what truly is. In the Platonic and Aristotelian epistemology that shaped Catholic Christianity, this means eternal ideas that exist a priori, of which physical things are pale and partial expressions. And Catholicism added to this, perhaps Protestantism also, but the idea of the hierarchy of revelation over reason. In other words, that revealed ideas are seen as coming directly from God and thus are unchangeable and unquestionable compared to sort of fallible ideas that derive from human reason. Gabara, by contrast, wants to start with experience, and especially the embodied experiences of actual women in daily life, experiences that cannot be translated into thought in a kind of final and definitive way, because they are always in context, they are always in particular network of relationships. And this interdependence and contextuality includes not only other humans, but the non-human world. Ultimately, the whole body of the cosmos in which we are embedded in our particular locations. So theological ideas are not exempt from this questioning, from the point of view of embodied and contextual experience. So, for example, Yvonne addresses the whole concept of God as Trinity. Certainly an idea that is often thought of as something that is far beyond the ordinary poor lay person understanding. But she says, let's ask some very basic questions about God as Trinity. To what kind of experience is this idea related? It's interesting to talk about that in a Unitarian church. to what experience is this concept related? What in our embodied daily life is the basis of thinking about reality as Trinitarian and hence of God as Trinity? And what she basically comes up with is that the concept of God as Trinity is really related to an experience of interrelationships, a kind of dynamic of reality as ramifying into great diversities and then coming into interconnections. And it's precisely in that kind of dialectic of diversity and interrelationship that we have this very vital experience, shall we say, of the Trinitarian character of reality. So she has a very incarnate and immanent understanding of Trinity. Now, this whole concept of talking about God as Trinity, you know, as a kind of metaphor for this dynamic of interrelationality, diversity, and communion, of course, then raises the whole question of how we deal with the issues of good and evil. In other words, if whatever develops is simply a part of a natural process, from whence comes systems of violence and oppression?
You are listening to Ecofeminism, a Global Comparative Approach. It was recorded by Radio EcoShock in the Unitarian Church of Vancouver on July 3, 2007. The speaker is Dr. Rosemary Ruther. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, listener-supported radio.
Now, Ivani would insist, excuse me if I call her Ivani, that happens to be her name, which I'm used to calling her, Ivani would insist that there is, in fact, good and evil in natural life itself. That is to say, natural life exists in a dynamic tension of life and death, creativity and vulnerability. And so death is, in fact, an integral part of life. It is not our enemy, but it is an integral part of life. And in fact, it is absolutely essential to the kind of cycle of renewal that we integrate, shall we say, the death or waste side of the life cycle. So for her, this vulnerability and this finitude is integral to the very nature of reality. But at the same time, our experiences of vulnerability and the fragility of life can also provide an impulse for, shall we say, the distortion of interrelationships. In other words, each person in a species context has a tendency to seek to protect and to expand their own life against others that compete with it. And nature limits the extent to which some species can expand at the expense of others. In other words, in the kind of animal world, if some exceed their life support niche by destroying the others on which they interdepend, this will precipitate the collapse of the dominant group as well. So you might say there's a kind of natural balancing pattern that goes on in the plant and animal world. But humans have developed an ability, shall we say, to resist these limits. They have been able to organize their own species power in relationship to land and animals and, of course, other human beings in a way that tries to monopolize the means of life. And so this takes place in the context of some humans seizing power and organizing relationships to other people. So these subjugated people do the brute labor. And those in power extract this into the means of wealth and dominating power and leisure for themselves at the expense of others, while, of course, always claiming to represent the well-being of the whole. So you might say it's this pattern of construction of systems of exploitive power of some humans over others and of course, over the non-human world that has been endlessly repeated through human history. These systems of exploitative distortion have always been based on denying the actual interconnections of the powerful with the powerless, of men with women, of ruling class with slaves and workers and peasants. Those on top imagine themselves to be somehow autonomous and naturally superior, while the inferiority of those they rule over demands their subjugation. And so the systems of exploitation, shall we say, constantly try to naturalize themselves. Naturalize themselves by shaping ideologies that pretend that these systems of exploitation simply represent the order of creation and, of course, the will of God or the gods. Now, for Ivani, we are living really at the point of the exhaustion, the crisis point of this whole system of distortion. that has grown increasingly centralized worldwide, while impoverishing the majority of humans and the earth more and more. And yet the system continues to claim that the privations that it imposes on others are necessary for all to eventually prosper and attain comfort and leisure equivalent to the affluent. In other words, if the poor would just tighten their belts, now, of course, who's got the tight belt already? If the poor would just tighten their belts, you know, this is the prescription of the World Bank and the IMF and so on, a little bit more, then the wealth that is generated at the top will trickle down, and again, they will lift all boats. But obviously, this is a fallacious ideology that is belied by reality. In other words, we have a few yachts that are floating and everybody else is sinking. And so it's a system of distortion, violence, impoverishment, and oppression, shall we say, which is really what is meant by immoral, or, if you might put it this way, unnatural evil, which is built up on the denial of the interconnections of all beings with one another. Now, for Gabara, there was no original paradise. There was no original paradise of blessedness where there was no finitude or death at the beginning of human history, nor is it possible to construct a paradise of deathless goodness in some future millennium. Rather, humans need to accept our limits, our fragility, our partial joys and sorrows within finite life. What we can and must do is to lessen the patterns of distortion that allow some few human beings to flourish inordinately at the expense of most other human beings and of the earth. So we need to shape more egalitarian societies where joys and sorrows, flourishing within fragile limits, are shared more equally and more justly between humans and between humans and other earth beings with whom we share this planet. So you might say this is the real but limited utopia that Yvonne Gabara allows herself, recognizing that within our lives today, we can expect perhaps only momentary glimpses of this more justly shared life in interconnected mutuality. So those are two very quick sketches of these two, I think, very interesting thinkers, which I suggest you all rush off after this lecture, get all of their books and read them. Now, the comparison of these two ecofeminist thinkers, one from India and the other from Brazil, seems to me to reveal some very interesting commonalities. And I don't think they have written with knowledge of each other's writings immediately, but nevertheless they have come up with some very interesting similarities. First of all, both of them, and in many other ecofeminist thinkers around the world, there is typically a very strong critique of Western epistemology. A critique of a epistemology that's based on the notion of the isolated knower who is somehow outside of and unrelated to reality, the reality that is known and whose knowledge is basically a function of power and control over others. So that whole model of epistemology is the knower who is outside knowing reality but in a way that essentially controls it is being questioned. And in that process, they are also questioning then a concept of self, a concept of the self based on the isolated individual disconnected from relationships which ignore the actual support services which other humans and nature are providing in order to create this sort of fictitional notion of the autonomous or independent individual. They are also, of course, rejecting a view of nature as dead matter. Dead matter to be dominated, in favor of an understanding of nature as living being in dynamic communities of life. They are calling for democratic relationships between humans, men and women, ethnic groups, those divided presently by class and race and culture, and they are seeking a new sense of partnership between humans and nature. So the keynotes of interrelationality, interdependency, and mutuality typically are echoing across these different perspectives, calling for a renewed sense of how humans should relate to one another and to the natural world. Now, the circulation of ecofeminist ideas across cultures today, it seems to me, resonates with very deep conflicts, struggles, and changes of consciousness that are happening worldwide. The destructive impact of the patterns of, quote, dominology, based on top-down epistemology, individualism, concept of the self as individual, and its relationship to other humans and nature, all of this tends to be seen as part of the roots of both sexism and racism, but also of imperialism, with its ongoing expressions in neocolonial exploitation of third world societies and their natural resources. So you might say there are groups of people all around the world that are struggling to identify these patterns and also to challenge them and to change them. So and that means that somewhat similar ideas of what is the needed alternative are emerging in many contexts and are linking up with one another. Now, it's often widely assumed in this kind of discourse that there is a need to refound local community, democratic face-to-face relationships with a variety of people, men and women, across classes and ethnic groups that are living in that community. There's a need for renewed regional communities to redevelop their relationship to land, to agriculture, to water in a sustainable way, based on democratic decision-making that takes all parties, including non-human nature, into consideration. But this also means resisting and withdrawing in some ways from centralized systems of control that have been forged by neocolonialism and imperialism. In other words, by banding together into communities of accountability, it is hoped that this system of domination, this global system of domination, can be undermined in some ways and changed to new ways of networking local communities across regions and ultimately across the globe. So you have visions of humans in interrelationship with one another and with nature, I think also expresses a very deep longing, a longing for alternative ways of situating people in relationship to society and to nature, to see nature as a living matrix of interconnection, providing the cosmological basis for this sense of an alternative understanding of how we are connected to each other. And this common ecofeminist worldview, I think, shares a couple of common characteristics, which I'll briefly characterize as I am concluding here. First of all, I think there is common across many of these views, coming from a variety of religious traditions, a rejection of the classical splitting of the divine from the earth and from the communities of life. And there was a rejection of the notion that God is some kind of personified, shall we say, male ego, located in some super celestial realm outside of the universe and ruling over it. So this concept of God is being deconstructed And the divine instead is seen more as, shall we say, a matrix of life-giving energy that is in and through and under all things. You could even, of course, quote Paul here. The one in whom we live and move and have our being. And this life-giving matrix, however, is not simply something that's reduced to what presently is. In other words, it's not simply a kind of static immanence, but rather this life-giving matrix also has a transformative edge. It both sustains the constant renewal of the natural cycles of life, but it also empowers us to struggle against the hierarchies of dominance and to create renewed relationships of mutual affirmation. So this divine energy for life and renewal of life, of course, this is not male or female or anthropomorphic in any literal sense, but rather it can be imagined in many ways, or should be imagined in many ways, that we celebrate our diverse bodies and spirits. In other words, what we need to exclude is gender stereotypes and metaphors that, shall we say, validate relationships of domination. But rather we need to celebrate all of the different ways that we are really enhanced and brought into mutually affirming relationships. My name for this is Divine Wisdom. Divine wisdom, which I think of as the font of life, the font of life that wells up to create and recreate all living things in what Thomas Berry calls ecozoic community. So I think of this, shall we say, as ecological wisdom, ecosophia, shall we call it. Ecological wisdom, which is calling us into life-giving community across many strands of traditions of culture and history, but also empowering us to stand shoulder to shoulder against the systems of economic, military, and ecological violence, which are threatening the very fabric of planetary life. That's it, folks.
That was theologian Dr. Rosemary Radford Ruther speaking on Ecofeminism, a Global Comparative Approach, and her name is spelled R-U-E-T-H-E-R if you want to look it up. It was recorded by Radio EcoShock in the Unitarian Church of Vancouver on July 3, 2007. You can download a copy of this speech in MP3 format, free, from our website at www.ecoshock.com. Look in the Greens section of our Audio On Demand menu. If you have comments on this program, write me, Alex Smith, at radio@ecoshock.org. Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock for in-depth environmental coverage on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Listen on the web at www.cooperadio.org, by cable, anywhere in British Columbia, by Star Choice Satellite, Channel 845, or download the program later from our website at ecoshock.org. Let's get together next week for more of Radio EcoShock.
Oh, the wheel of the year goes round and round. The wheel of the year goes round. Turns top to the bottom and the bottom to the top. And the wheel of the year goes round and round. Oh, the seed does die and the grass spring. At harvest time it is reaped and mown. Then the seed does die and the grass does spring, and the wheel of the year goes round and round. Oh, the wheel of the year goes round and round. The wheel of the year goes round. Turns top to the bottom and the bottom to the top, and the wheel of the year goes round and round. At Lammas time the shade we bless, at Imbolc dark the fires we fan, then the gather